For some reason, my shopping list was the hottest thing she had ever heard, and when I listed the variety of food that I had brought back for her, she began to climax. As soon as she had come down, I flipped her over so I could take her from behind. As I slid inside of her and pulled her hips back into me, I told her that I had also brought her a special treat, a delicacy that humans called chocolate. Her resulting orgasm sent startled birds erupting from the tops of all the nearby trees. An hour later, we rose from bed, and I brought the wares over to the table and laid everything out. Nika had 100 questions about the new and delightful things I had bought, and I happily explained them to her. She sampled the bread, fruit, vegetables, and finally the chocolate. Her appetite for food almost matched her appetite for sex, and my heart swelled at how happy she was.
"Can we eat those animals, too?"
she asked as she eyed the chickens hungrily. "We could, but they will provide us with eggs every day. We'll eat some eggs, but we'll let the rest hatch. Then we can start eating chicken once a week or so."
"So they will make new ones that we can eat?" Nika gasped. "Ken, Jewel, you are amazing."
"I just want to take care of you and the baby," I said with a shrug and smile.
"I wish to take care of you as well," she said as she proudly showed off a baby basket that she had fashioned from thin wooden branches. "Look what I made while you were gone."
"Wow, that's beautiful, Nika," I said. Her craftsmanship in making such things was truly impressive. I bought some cloth as well, and some thread and a needle kit. I figured that it would come in handy if you wanted to make a blanket or a tablecloth. Oh, and I got you something else. I cleaned off my hands and presented her with the lacy pink sundress. Her eyes watered as she beheld the beautiful garment, and she hugged me fiercely.
"Oh, Ken Jewel, you are too good to me."
"I know," I teased. "Go try it on." She stripped out of my t-shirt and underwear and pulled the dress over her head. I had guessed right, and the dress fit her perfectly. It hugged every curve of her wonderful body and made her small baby bump that much more noticeable. "Wow, you're really starting to show," I noted. She beamed at me and caressed her tummy lovingly.
"Yes, and the baby is going to be very strong and healthy. You are a good provider, Ken Jewel."
I let Nika take over the cooking of the fish and set my focus on the construction of the house. The first thing I needed was to outline the frame, and that meant cutting down a lot of trees. Felling axe in hand, I trudged down the hill and surveyed the nearby forest. Pine was the best wood to use for a log home, and there was an abundance of it. The only problem was that the best-looking trees were on the other side of the river. The most obvious solution was to build a bridge, but the effort would prove risky, not because I couldn't do it, but because anyone heading down the river would see the bridge and realize there was probably a home nearby. Then I glanced downriver and was reminded of the rapids. I'd gotten off my rowboat because they had looked pretty dangerous, so I doubted that anyone else would bother trying to row up through them. It also meant that I really only have to worry about someone coming down the river, but they would also eventually have to worry about the rapids, so I guessed that anyone local would probably not even bother. It wasn't the safest bet, but the only other option would be building a boat to haul the logs across, and that would take much longer and be much more dangerous. So I decided to build a bridge, and I figured that I could take it down as soon as I had collected all the logs I needed. I set to the task eagerly. I was in a good mood. My woman was happy, we had food, and I wasn't in goddamn Syria fighting nut jobs. Right about then, life couldn't have gotten much better. The weather was on our side as well, and as the second sun rose in the east, I started to fell the lumber that I would need for my bridge. At its most narrow, the river was 20 feet wide, so I picked a couple of tall pine trees that grew on the bank and began chopping them down. They would be a bitch to move, but if all went well, I wouldn't have to do much more than nudge them a little on each side to get them into position. I really needed a beast of burden for the job, and an ox would have been ideal, but I didn't have the money for one, so for now I was going to have to make do with homemade winches and pulley systems. I didn't have the technology available to create a cofferdam, and I had no way of effectively driving support beams into the middle of the river, so I was going to have to make do with a simple beam bridge.
The pines I had chosen were more than 30 feet tall, and their length would make them strong enough to span the 20-foot-wide river without much bending. "Timber!" I yelled as the first pine tree creaked and began to fall. I had planned the drop perfectly, and the tree fell across the river and crashed onto the distant bank. The next tree fell similarly, but it was 15 feet away from the first. I would have to move them closer together, but first I needed to cut off all the branches. I stepped up onto the first tree, found my balance, and went to work carefully chopping off the branches. By the time I had finished cleaning them both, Nika called to me from up on the hill. It was lunchtime. I joined her at the table, and we enjoyed a bountiful meal of roasted fish, apples, and bread. I told Nika my plans for the bridge and the pulley system to haul the logs up the hill, and she shared with me her plans to decorate our little abode. I debated whether I should tell her about the bounty on my head or the men who had been looking for me, but I decided that honesty was my best bet. After all, I wouldn't have wanted her to keep something like that from me, so I told her everything that had happened. She took the news stoically and even seemed proud that her husband had gained such a large bounty. She even laughed at the nicknames, Crazy Ken and the Monster Lover from Myrrh Bay. I had heard the latter in passing, and I thought it had quite a nice ring to it.
"You are already a notorious outlaw, Ken Jewel," she said with pride. "Soon everyone in the surface world and in the Underdark will know and fear your name."
"I don't want to be feared, Nika. I just want to be left alone."
"I think you can have both, yes?"
She nodded to herself.
"Yes, if they fear you, then maybe they will leave us alone. If not, then we will just have to crush them all with our army and take their loot."
"What army?" I asked.
"The army of your monster children, of course, Ken Jewel," she answered. "You will be unstoppable."
I shook my head and smiled at her unwavering positivity. It seemed like nothing could dampen her spirits, and that in turn made me feel like I was almost invincible. The food did me a lot of good, and by the time I returned to my work, I felt like a man reborn. I used the rope along with the block and tackle that I had bought from the man at the tool supply store to create a simple winch. I anchored them against one of the largest of the trees adjacent to where I wanted to make the bridge, and then I nudged the big pines into place on our side of the river. I then walked across one of the trees and similarly adjusted the other side. Once the logs were in place, I secured them with stakes fashioned from the thicker branches and tied them down. I had set the logs 6 feet apart, and there weren't any other trees in the area I could use to make baseboards. There were plenty on the far side of the river, though, so I balance-beamed across the water on one of the trees I had just winched into place, and then proceeded to chop down a couple of tall pines there. Once I had chopped all the branches off the felled trees, I sawed off 20 6-foot-long logs that would connect the beams and act as a walkway. The twin suns burned bright overhead while I worked, and by the time I had nailed and tied down the last of my pine logs, the first sun had begun to flirt with the western horizon. I glanced at my watch and was surprised to find that I had been working for more than 10 hours. The time difference still had me all kinds of confused, but I was beginning to get used to the long days. I decided it was time to take a break and joined Nika for dinner. We ate bread, cheese, and some fish Nika had caught as the chickens grazed on the hillside. I was going to need to build a chicken coop at some point, but I had so much work ahead of me already that I put the thought aside for now. Until I had built them a suitable coop, they were just going to have to sleep in the unfinished house. Dinner made me crave coffee, and I remembered the tea that I had bought. One of the pouches smelled like green tea, and the other hinted at Earl Grey. I brewed some green tea, added some sugar, and sat on the hillside with Nika to enjoy the new beverage.
"Your bridge is beautiful and very clever," she said as she admired my handiwork.
"It's not the best I've ever made," I admitted, "but it will get the job done. Now that it's finished, I can begin hauling logs from the other side of the river." I glanced up at the Holy Twins. "But we've only got about 6 hours of daylight left, and I'm pretty beat. I'll probably just focus on cutting down the pine trees we need with what's left of the day." The next morning, I awoke before sunrise and put the kettle on the fire.
Nika and I watched the first sun emerge from the east and ate a breakfast of bread, apples, and cheese. Nika enjoyed the new tastes immensely, and she sat across from me and chewed with ecstasy the entire time. When she caught me staring, she blushed, and her cheeks actually became a few shades greener.
"The baby loves the new food that you have provided," she said.
"Oh, yeah? It's a bit of a luxury. It will only last a few days, and we'll have to go back to fishing."
"That's okay," Nika said as she smiled at me. "The baby just likes to eat."
"Damn," I chuckled. "Does the baby want more?" I noticed how she eyed the chickens as they grazed on the hillside.
"Oh, yes," she said. "The baby always wants more. He loves this surface food, but he also wants things only found in the Underdark, like lizard brains, glowing mushrooms, lichen pudding, tadpole soup, baby turtles on a half shell, and basilisk meat. I think you should go back into the Underdark soon. We will definitely need more loot, yes? And you can get the baby the food he wants, too."
"Back into the Underdark?" I asked. "That's about the last place I want to go. But you're right, those kobolds were carrying a surprisingly good amount of coins, and we're going to need more supplies at some later point in time."
"Yep," she said happily. "And you need to find more monster women to bring to the surface and make babies with. It is nice with just you and me here, but I can't wait to have a big family."
"You mean an army?"
"Same thing," she said. "Clan Jewel will be legendary. You will see."
"It's going to take a bit of time," I said as I glanced at her baby bump. "You've gotten bigger, but it will be a few months before he is..."
"Oh, no, Ken Jewel," she laughed. "The baby will come in just a few weeks."
"A few weeks?" I gasped as I spit out my tea.
"Of course, silly,"
she giggled as she reached to wipe the tea off my chin.
"How long do human women carry their unborn babies?"
9 months, I said as I calculated the time that had passed since we first had sex.
"Yes, but don't worry, Ken Jewel. You will have the warren finished by the time your son is born."
"Yeah," I said as I stood up from the chair and grabbed my axes. "I'd better get to it." The next day I redoubled my efforts. I needed to get the house built, but talk of the Underdark had reminded me that there was still a cave leading to the place just a half-hour walk from our homestead, and it was a problem that needed to be remedied. Sooner was better than later. I approached the cave cautiously. There were no tracks leading from the entrance, but inside there were dozens of footprints from the little kobold devils that had chased us out more than a week before. I sniffed at the air, but smelled nothing but the musk of dark, wet places. I listened for 10 long minutes, but heard nothing but the steady flow of water in the walls and distant frog songs. The tunnel that we had raced down to get out was more than 100 feet long, and when I walked to the end of it, I noticed there was another passageway that we had missed because it had been behind us. M17 and flashlight in hand, I explored the new lair. The tunnel smelled like moss and fungus, and the only sound that came from within was the steady plop of distant water. The cave proved to be only 20 feet deep and lined with bright red moss. Halfway through the tunnel, there was a large hole in the floor surrounded by a narrow ridge that led to a small shelf. Water slowly dripped from the ceiling into the dark pit, and I pointed my flashlight down there to see how deep it ran. The water took 10 seconds between the time it dripped from the ceiling before it hit the distant pool, and my flashlight beam barely revealed the water below. I continued exploring the tunnel and soon circled back to the main passageway. This new entrance was a bit of a tight squeeze to get out of, and I hadn't noticed it at first because it was positioned between two extending rocks on the wall. It meant that the side passage was in a bit of a horseshoe U-shape that intersected the main exit tunnel. Then I got an idea and wiggled backwards so I was back near the pit. The pit would provide an excellent place for a booby trap, so I went back to the homestead and gathered the things that I would need. After I brought them back into the tunnel, I set to work covering the 8-foot-wide pit with thin branches, and then I covered them with the red moss that grew on the walls. If anything chased me from the Underdark, I could lead them down the side tunnel, maneuver around the narrow rim, and lie in wait in the small alcove. If all went as planned, My pursuers would chase me across the pit and fall through the weak branches to their sudden deaths. I might not ever need to use the pitfall, but it had only taken me a half an hour of work, and I felt a lot better with it in place. Once I had finished the pitfall, I decided to add some feather spear traps near the entrance. After selecting two strong spring sticks, I sharpened spear points out of oak and attached them with Nika's woven vine rope. Then I placed one trip line on each side of the entrance to ensure that no matter what way the monsters or underdark creatures went, they would be impaled by one of the spring sticks. Then I marked both sides of the wall by the trip line with a kind of chalk-like stone for my own safety. Lastly, I added a trip line to the tunnel entrance set to a deadfall trap that would set off one of my M17 bullets. I didn't want to waste any of my precious ammunition, but with the cave a half hour from our homestead, the use of one of the bullets was the best way to alert me that someone or something had breached the cave during the night. When I was content with my work on the underdark traps, I returned to the homestead to continue building the house. Between the home and the defensive walls I wanted to put around our fort area, I determined that I would need about 100 pine logs at least 10 feet long and 12 inches in diameter. It was time to get all lumberjack on these guys. The felling axe was a great tool, and I only needed to sharpen it after every fifth tree I had cut down. By the time Nika came to bring me lunch, my arms were numb and my back was tired.
"How many trees did you chop down, Kenjul?" she asked as we ate.
25, I answered.
"You must be the strongest man in the world," she gasped.
"Thanks," I laughed, "but there is plenty more work to do. I have to take all the branches off and plane the edges. This will be more than enough for the walls of the home, but I'll need a bunch more to build a wall around the homestead."
"You must be the hardest working man in the world," she purred.
"Maybe," I joked. "But the army got me used to doing hard work."
"Did they teach you how to build warrens in the army, too?" she asked.
"The army taught me how to build a lot of stuff, but the job was mostly about building bridges, blowing up bridges, fixing broken stuff we liked, and then blowing up other stuff we didn't like." I laughed. "The cabin stuff I learned from my dad. When I was 17, we built a log cabin for my grandmother to live in the backyard. Before that, my brother and I used to build forts all the time."
"So you come from a family of great warren builders?" she asked.
"Yeah, kinda," I replied.
"Then your army taught you how to build and destroy things for war?"
she asked as her green eyes grew wider. "Yeah," I replied.
"Oh, Kenjul," she sighed happily. "You will be the bestest emperor in the entire world. It won't take long either, maybe just a few years. I am so blessed to be the wife of such a great man. You are a wonderful provider, lover, builder, and general. Soon you will be a great father. I will do my part to be the bestest wife I can possibly be."
"That sounds great," I said, and then I blinked a few times as I reminded myself about how crazy all this was. Just a few days ago, I had been about to die in Syria, and now I was about to be a father to a half-goblin, half-human baby. For half a moment, I almost freaked out, but Nika's bright smile kept me rooted to the ground. This beautiful woman had absolute faith in me, and I knew that I wouldn't ever let her down. After lunch, I started narrowing the logs with my side axe. The blade was set on the left side of the haft for right-handed users, and it allowed me to make cuts that were closer to the surface of my target than a normal hatchet would have. I chopped perpendicular traverses every foot on both sides of the logs, carved off the bark, and then proceeded to plane them flat. When the day began to wane, I joined Nika for a second dinner, then collapsed into bed like one of my felled logs. In the morning, my muscles were sore, but I worked through the discomfort. Ever since I was about 13 years old, I had exercised regularly, and the army didn't give a shit about overworking people, so I was used to ignoring such growing pains. Nika asked if she could help me, but her bump was starting to become more pronounced, so I insisted that she just focus on the smaller branches while I handled dragging the beefier logs. Once all the wood was up to the site, I chose my bottom logs and carefully carved them to fit the foundation. While I worked, Nika went down to the riverbank and the dark parts of the forest to collect moss, and we used it to seal the spaces between the bottom logs and the stone foundation. I placed the center beam and built a support wall through the middle of the house to give us two rooms. It was more work, but I liked the design better than a single opened-air cabin. The added support would also help to strengthen the ceiling joists and support the roof. It took some work, notching the corners of the logs and getting them just right, but by the time nightfall came, we had half of the walls up. We finished the remainder of the walls the following day, cut out the doors and windows, and began on the ceiling joists. I elected to secure two logs together for each joist and connected them with a dovetail notch that sat on the center wall. We used a ramp and rope system to get the lumber up onto the roof and worked on the tables until yet another day had passed.
"I have never seen a more beautiful Warren," Nika told me as we stood and admired our work in the light of the waning second sun. "How did you ever think of building something this amazing, Ken Jewel?"
"Wait until it's done. It's going to be nice and warm and dry," I said. "No more sleeping under the stars at the mercy of the elements." It hadn't yet rained since I'd been on the new planet, but I didn't know if that was strange or not. I was looking forward to it, since I guessed Nika hadn't yet experienced rain, and I guessed that she was going to absolutely love it. All the days of working meant that we were starting to get low on food again. Fish were bountiful in the river, and I had caught two more hares, but 7 days had passed since my return, and in another week I would have to go into town for more supplies. I wanted to buy a mule and a cart as well, and I needed to get a lot more food this time. The less I went into the neighboring towns, the better, so I was looking to stockpile. I also needed some more tools, and real glass windows, if I could find them. But first, I had to get money, and that meant going back into the Underdark again. Nika had been on me about getting her the exotic food that she and the baby craved, but I wanted to finish the house before I went back into the dark underbelly of this strange new world. The next day I started on the roof and built up the gables with the pitch of the roof in mind. I still didn't know if it snowed here, but it didn't hurt to be prepared. If I made the pitch too shallow, then the snow would collect, and there would be more of a chance of leaking. So I settled for a 45-degree slope. Once my gables were mounted and the dowels were in place, I used a rafter model to draw lines on the gables, then carved off the excess wood. Next, I nailed the roof truss and attached the center beam to the ceiling joists and sidewalls. Another day passed and was spent chopping down the fattest oak I could find and sawing 2-foot slabs off the trunk. Once I had a half dozen quality pieces, I used my saw to cut out the hundreds of shingles that I would need. I managed to fashion all of my roof planks by the end of the day as well. By the time the sun set the following day, I had nailed down all my planks and placed my shingles. All that was left was the windows and the doors, along with some touch-up work, but before I could do that, I needed to get our money situation taken care of. It was time to head back into the Underdark.
Chapter 9.
"You look like a mighty goblin king," Nika giggled while applying the last of my camo makeup to my face.
"Thanks," I said as I checked her work in my signaling mirror. "You did a great job."
"Can I help you put your pack on?" she asked, and I nodded as she reached for it.
An hour or so ago, I went through my molly pack and took out the items that I didn't think I would need in the Underdark. Stealth and speed were going to be important on this mission, so I had removed most of the unnecessary items from the pack, and I'd gotten the weight down to about 30 pounds. Nika strapped it on my back, and I tested its weight and my maneuverability by doing a few squats. Happy with the result, I grabbed a spear that I had made and considered bringing one of the axes. The big axe that I had felled the trees with would come in handy against a larger opponent, but it would be cumbersome to swing. The side axe, on the other hand, was much smaller and considerably lighter, so I settled on that one and strapped it to my molly pack. I didn't plan on being down in the Underdark for an extended period of time, but I brought along 2 of my MREs just in case of emergencies.
"Don't forget this," Nika said as she handed me her Underdark grocery list.
"This is a lot of food," I said as I scanned over the strange items. Does that say Minotaur balls?
Oh, yes, she said with a smile and trailed her hand down my chest. They are a delicacy, and they are known to increase libido.
Increase libido? I asked with a laugh. We have sex like twice a day, sometimes three times. You are insatiable, aren't you?
I am very satisfied with your performance, Ken Jewel, but soon you will have many wives, and the Minotaur balls will be very useful.
I couldn't help but laugh at that one. It wasn't every day that your goblin wife reminded you to pick up some Underdark Viagra so that you could have sex with other monster women. Man, I was living the life. Are you sure you're going to be all right by yourself? I asked her before I set out for the cave.
You worry too much, Ken Jewel. I'm very sneaky and good at hiding, and you're the strongest man I've ever seen. Everything will be perfect.
All right, honey. I gave her a long kiss and hugged her tight. I'll be back before you know it.
Good luck,
she called after me as I hiked across the ridge. A half hour later, I reached the entrance to the Underdark and approached it with caution. There were no signs that monsters had emerged from the cave, so I turned on my flashlight and crept in slowly. Kobold tracks still littered the entrance, but nothing had set off the trip line attached to the deadfall trap, and none of the feather spear traps had been set off either. Deeper in, I took a minute to check my pitfall trap. I was proud at how well hidden it was. Had I not known it was there, I would have thought nothing of the pile of red moss that covered the sticks. The stuff grew everywhere, and my pitfall trap blended in perfectly. I headed back down the tunnel and began to map it out with my Sharpie and the little book that Nika had stolen from the travelers. I already knew that this tunnel led to the hot spring pool where Nika and I had first made love. Beyond that, it opened up to a variety of other tunnels that Nika and I had run past during our hasty escape from the kobolds. Moving further in, I stopped before two such passages. One of them looked familiar, but the other one was littered with the glowing mushrooms that Nika had asked me to get, so I decided to see where that one led as I picked the mushrooms. Nika had asked that I only gather the mushroom caps, and I collected a few dozen by the time I reached the end of the patch. I had traveled about a half a mile into the tunnel and guessed that I was about 200 feet beneath the surface, given how the grade mostly moved downward. Once I drew the location of the mushroom patch on my expanding map, I ventured into the next tunnel. Then I saw all the bones. They reminded me of the basilisk den I had ventured into on the first day, and I sniffed the air and thought I picked up the faint smell of rotting meat. My first instinct was to turn back, but snake meat was high on Nika's list, and I didn't want to let her down. Maybe this den belonged to a smaller snake than the one who'd shed the skin that I had seen before. That was my hope as I ventured deeper into the increasingly creepy tunnel littered with countless bones. I gripped the shaft of the spear in my hand as I came to another junction. Two tunnels branched off from the one that I traversed, so I marked them on my map and followed my nose to the one on the left. The scent of death became more pungent down that dark hall, and my flashlight showed me the bones of many hapless creatures. About 20 feet into the tunnel, I discovered two human skeletons who looked to have been swallowed whole and digested with their clothes on. They wore rags, and their bags had been reduced to tatters as well, but the loot and the tools that they carried survived the snake's stomach. One of the dead men had been carrying a sword, and while the sheath looked to have been partially digested, the blade was unmarred. I slowly pulled the short sword from its sheath and admired the blade. The hilt was smooth ivory bound in leather, and the blade curved slightly, like a cutlass. Happy with the find, I strapped the sword to my belt and went through the rest of the skeletons. I found 2 gold coins and 5 silver inside the tattered remains of what had once been a coin purse. Among the bones, I found 2 rings as well. One appeared to be pure gold and held a large ruby. The other was entirely silver and marked with strange runes. I found a gold chain at the feet of one of the skeletons, and when I dusted it off and picked it up, I was shocked by its weight. The thick, woven chain reminded me of something that a rapper might have worn, and I stuffed it in my molly pack while imagining all the supplies I could buy with it. A heartbeat later, my happy daydreams were disrupted by a sinister hiss, and I froze. The sound had come from right behind me. I whipped around and came face to face with the biggest snake head that I had ever seen. It must have been the size of an easy chair, and as I looked into its serpentine green eyes, my body froze. The sudden paralysis scared the hell out of me, and I cursed myself for not remembering that in some fantasy stories, basilisks could paralyze their victims with but a glance. The snake was about 20 feet away, and it surged through the tunnel toward me as I stared helplessly. Panic almost consumed my mind, but then I realized that I'd die down here if I didn't move. And if I died, no one would be able to take care of Nika and our baby. I let out a primal yell and regained control of my body just as the snake was almost on top of me. Instinct set in, and I spun around to run. As I turned, I thrust the business end of my spear back behind me and felt the tip connect a moment before the giant snake hissed. The weapon was ripped from my grip, and I shot forward like an Olympic sprinter. The thing sounded like it was right on my heels as I ran, and I knew that, at any moment, its massive fangs would sink into my shoulders. I would promptly be swallowed whole, and that would be the untimely end of Clan Jewel. The cave suddenly opened up into a large den, and I leapt to the right a second before the basilisk struck. I spun in the air, landed among the bones, and brought my M17 to bear. The snake missed me, and its face crashed into a pile of bones. I remembered to avoid the beast's hypnotic gaze and fired off 3 shots that tore into the side of its head. But I might as well have been trying to take down a whale shark with a slingshot. The snake didn't even seem to notice the bullets, and it slowly rose from the pile of bones and turned its malevolent gaze my way. I avoided eye contact as I scrambled to my feet, ran to my right, and ducked behind a wide stalagmite. Then I traded out my M17 for my side axe and surveyed my surroundings. The den was more than 100 feet deep and twice as wide. The concave ceiling rose and fell, curving around stalactites that dripped moisture with the slow and steady pace of sand falling through an hourglass. The basilisk pursued me around the wide stalagmite, but I wasn't about to go running out into the open. Instead, I followed the wide formation all the way back to where I had started and found the snake's tail. The thing had to be at least 30 feet long, and I heard it sliding around the assorted stalagmites behind me. I needed a plan, and one quickly came to mind. I had seen a small nook on my way around the formation, and when I came upon it again, I shouldered inside and lay in wait with my pistol in my offhand. Seconds later, the slowly stalking basilisk approached. It hissed and slithered as its forked tongue tasted the air, and I began to regret my decision to hide in the nook. When the tongue came into sight, I froze and held my breath as my heartbeat slammed through my temples. The serpentine head emerged next, and I turned my eyes away to stare at the stone in front of me so I wouldn't get paralyzed again. Then the snake paused in front of my hiding spot, and I aimed my gun at it as I forced myself to exhale as slowly and softly as I possibly could. It stayed still for a few moments with its tongue flicking the air, and then it turned away from me and began to move through the tunnel once more. I thanked my lucky stars, took a deep breath, and then sprang for my hiding place. The monster hadn't expected my attack, and I landed right on his back, a good 3 feet behind his head, and buried my axe in the rear part of his skull. The beast reeled back when my axe cut into it, and I was thrown free by the strength of its thrashing. I rolled to the side and thought it was going to try to bite me, but it smashed its head on a low-hanging stalactite instead. The formation shattered and rained down on the snake as I ducked back into my nook. The collapse of the stalactite kicked up a cloud of dust and debris, and the basilisk hissed and thrashed. I hadn't managed to hurt it much, but I had sure as hell pissed it off. The snake couldn't get to me in that small space without once again going around the stalagmite, and when its tail disappeared from view through the dust cloud, I leapt from my hiding place and hurriedly climbed up the formation. I managed to climb about 10 feet before the basilisk's head appeared in the tunnel below me. It instantly slithered toward my previous hiding place and thrust its head in, so I unsheathed the short sword and leapt from my perch. My attack was aimed true, and I landed on the basilisk's head and drove the sword right through its head. The snake shrieked loud enough to shake the rock formations, and I was suddenly riding it like a bull. Whoops. I held on to the hilt of my sword for dear life with my left hand and hacked into the snake's right eye with my side axe until it became a bloody pulp. The beast reeled back in an attempt to smash me into the walls of the cave, but I slid down its back as its head slammed into the wall 10 feet above me. Blood poured from the creature's eye socket like a shower as I rolled off its back and onto my pack, and then I jumped to my feet and ran toward its tail. I was a bit surprised that the monster wasn't dead from my stab to its brain, so I continued my run past its thrashing tail and made for my dropped spear. The basilisk's menacing hiss resonated through the den as bones crunched beneath my big boots. I skidded into the main tunnel and found my spear laying on the floor. Behind me, the telltale sound of the basilisk slithering across the floor echoed. I guessed it was right on my heels, so I dove for my spear and came up in a roll with the weapon in my hand. Had I been but a moment later, and I would have been dead. The basilisk struck as I slammed the butt of the spear into a nook, and I braced my arms for the impact. Its mouth was open wide, and teeth as long as swords came toward me, but my spear sunk deep into the roof of the beast's mouth, and it stopped less than a foot from engulfing me. Then I shoved the barrel of my M17 into its uninjured cereal bowl-sized eye and pulled the trigger. Blood, brain, and bone exploded out the back of the creature's skull. The basilisk teetered, swayed from side to side, and then fell with a colossal boom to the tunnel floor. "Fuck yeah," I gasped after my heart had stopped racing. "Look at you now, you scaly bitch." I kicked the basilisk in the head and proceeded to retrieve my short sword. It took some doing, but I finally got it free from the snake's skull. Over the next half hour, I carved out a big chunk of basilisk meat and wrapped it up in my poncho. The slab weighed about 20 pounds, and I knew that Nika would be delighted. After procuring the meat, I decided to take the snake's fangs. They were almost 3 feet long and would come in handy as weapons or for booby traps. The fangs turned out to be stronger than I thought, but eventually I broke them off at the base with a big rock and strapped them to my pack. After notating the location of the basilisk den on my little map, I looted the rest of the skeletons in the den. There were a surprising number of what I thought were dwarven carcasses. They wore strong metal armor, but none of it would fit me or Nika, so I focused on their weapons. There were a variety of axes and hatchets, so I took the ones I liked best and put them in my molly pack. The dwarves were blinged out like Hollywood pop stars, and I happily looted gold rings and necklaces holding rubies and shimmering diamonds. I didn't know a lot about the local money markets, but I knew I had a small fortune on my hands, and I was going to need a small fortune if I wanted to start building an empire. With renewed confidence, I set out to gather the remainder of the items on Nika's list. I found the lizards that she had told me about in a cave not far from the basilisk den. They were the size of iguanas and surprisingly fast, but I managed to kill 4 of them. Nika was only interested in the brains, so I cut off their heads and added them to my loot. Next, I located the white lichen that she had mentioned, then shaved it off the stones that it grew on and filled one of my molly pack pockets with the flex. As I explored new passages and strange new caverns, I came across a small underground pond teeming with life. The glowing crystals grew here as well, illuminating the body of water and making it practically translucent. The pond glowed like something out of a dream. And in it, I could see strange new fish and eels swimming about, along with turtles and frogs and weird-looking bipedal creatures with fish heads. At the shore, I gathered tadpoles for Nika and stuffed them in a zipper pocket. There were more mushrooms here, so I grabbed those along with the moss. The creatures with fish heads looked annoyed by my presence, but they didn't really move toward me. They were only about 2 feet tall, but their razor-sharp teeth and the claws at the ends of their webbed fingers told me that they could be trouble, so I left them in their little pool behind and ventured back the way I had come. My map was getting pretty big, and I was starting to feel a lot more comfortable in the Underdark, so I decided to spend only another hour there before heading back to the surface. I doubled back to the fork in the tunnel near the basilisk den and took one of the tunnels that I hadn't explored yet.
This one was also riddled with the glowing crystal formations that lent a soft glow to the mineral-rich walls. I was reminded of my idea to see if the crystals could charge my flashlight batteries, and broke one off with a rock. The crystal was about 6 inches long and glowed with soft blue light, like a mystical wand from a fantasy game. The thing continued to glow even after it was separated from its main body, so I stashed it in my pack and kept going. Soon I came to a giant underground cavern that seemed to have no end. I walked out on a wide sheet of stone, and 20 feet from the tunnel it dropped off into pure darkness. Stalactites and stalagmites grew here as well, some more than 100 feet high, or hanging so far into the chasm that their tips were impossible to see. To my right, the shelf stopped abruptly, but to my left, it continued around an expanse of stone. I carefully explored the crumbling edge, and then I heard distant voices. I froze and whipped my head left, right, up and down, but I couldn't see anyone or anything coming. The voices drew closer, however, and soon they sounded like they were right on top of me. Or under me. I moved to the ledge and dared a peek over the side. I saw the creatures then as they moved along another shelf about 20 feet below me. There were 3 of them, and they wore some sort of scaled leather and carried mean-looking spears and torches. Their green skin reminded me of Nika's, only rougher. They were goblins, and boy were they all sorts of ugly. I held my breath partially because I wanted to be as quiet as possible, but also because they smelled like boiled cabbage and mildew. The acrid stink burned my nostrils, and I thanked the heavens that Nika hadn't inherited her people's rank odor.
"Let's take a break," one of the goblins said. His voice was nasal and high-pitched, and he sounded like he had a mouthful of marbles, but I could still make out his words.
"No breaks, you too lazy, Urgug," the tallest of the 3 said annoyedly. "I plan on finding the ugly girl and getting the reward. You go back if you want. More treasure for Kukka and me."
"Yeah, more treasure,"
chortled the short fat goblin beside him, presumably Kukka.
"Ah, shut up, Kukka,"
Urgog yelled and kicked him in the ass from behind. A fight broke out, and I watched as the 2 goblins rolled around and tried to choke the life out of one another. I was about to slink back from the ledge when the leader suddenly yelled at his partners.
"Knock it off, you 2 morons. Save your strength for finding Princess Nika Gikukara."
I froze.
"She didn't come this way anyhow,"
Urgug said as he finally let Kukka get up.
"You don't know what I know, because you're a moron who only thinks of food,"
the leader told him.
"Oh yeah? What do you know?"
Urgog asked.
"Why are you searching here when every other group is looking in the saltwater caverns?"
"If you must know," the leader began, "I trapped a kobold a few days ago who told me that he and a war party had chased an ugly goblin woman into these caves."
"How do you know it was the princess?"
"The kobold said she was as ugly as a mermaid," the leader explained.
"Meh. You can't trust those stinking kobolds,"
Urgog said.
"They'll say anything to be set free."
"You have a better idea?"
the leader challenged, and when Urgog said nothing, the leader nodded with finality.
"Good. Then shut up and keep walking."
The group looked like they were climbing up the ledge, and I saw that the lip ended up on a path that would wind around toward me. I was going to need to get out of here, so I slowly crawled away from the cavern and didn't stand up to start jogging until I was completely sure that I was out of earshot. Nika was a goblin princess? Why hadn't she told me? The revelation made me realize how much danger we were really in. If there was a hefty reward for Nika, then there must have been dozens, maybe hundreds, of similar groups searching for her. My heart hammered in my chest as I hurried toward the tunnel that would lead me back to the exit, but then I stopped when I realized that I couldn't escape yet. The leader of the goblin party on the ledge below me had information that seemed to have been a secret, and if I let them go now, I ran the risk of them telling others about Nika.
If Nika's father somehow learned that Nika survived in the sunlight from the kobolds, he might begin sending war parties to the surface to find her. I couldn't risk that. I went back to the left ridge and spied the goblins. As I expected, they were about 200 yards away and climbing up the rock face to my shelf. I waited to make sure that they were indeed headed my way, and then crept back from the outcropping of rock and waited. The goblins were between 3 and 5 feet tall, with the leader being the tallest. And there were 3 of them, so I intended on taking out at least one of them immediately. They carried only spears from what I had seen, but the weapons looked pretty solid, and I had no idea if they laced them with some kind of poison or not. I could have used my M17 and dispatched them all easily, but I didn't want to use any more bullets if I didn't have to, and I needed the leader alive to interrogate. Right about then, I wished I had brought the kobold net, but that was still being used as a hammock down by the river. With no time to set up a trap, I grabbed a big rock that was about 40 pounds and moved to the stone facet beside the spot where they would come around the narrow ridge. I knew that the leader would emerge first, and it meant that I would have to time my throw just right. I hid behind an outcropping of jutting rock beside the ridge about 5 feet away from the corner, and waited. The seconds ticked by slowly as the goblins approached, and the adrenaline began to seep into my system. Their acrid taint burned my nostrils, and I wondered how Nika had ever lived with the ugly beasts. Then they stopped.
"You smell that?"
"I don't smell nothing," Kukka said.
"Smells like nasty human,"
Urgog cried.
"Shut up,"
the leader hissed, and I took a deep breath as I shifted the heavy rock in my hands.
"Kukka," the leader whispered. "You go on around that corner and see if the way's clear." "And if it ain't?"
the buffoon asked.
"If it ain't, then that's what you report. Now go on and get."
The sound of a foot finding an ass echoed through the cavern, and shuffling feet began to sound on the ridge. A moment later, a blank-faced Kukka rounded the corner with his fat green belly leading the way. Then his eyes opened wide when he saw me.
"Catch,"
I whispered as I tossed him the heavy stone. The startled goblin dropped his spear, caught the stone, stumbled back because of its weight, and then lost his balance. He fell off the ledge as he shrieked, and the scream lasted for almost 5 seconds. Then it abruptly ended with a splat sound.
"Kukka, you idiot, what are you doing down there?"
It was Urgog, and he sounded more annoyed than upset.
"He's bleeding to death on the rocks, you dummy,"
the leader said.
"Did you see what happened?"
"I didn't see nothing but Kukka falling."
"Go on and check things out,"
the leader commanded.
"What do you mean?"
Another foot to the ass echoed, and Urgog groaned miserably.
"Fine, fine, I'll go. Stop kicking me."
When he came around the corner rubbing his ass, I planted one of my new axes in his head. He stopped dead, his eyes crossed, to focus on the blade embedded in his forehead, and then he dropped like a rock. The leader of the group roared and charged around the corner as I yanked the axe from the goblin's head. I pulled my short sword from its sheath as I backpedaled, and the goblin leader leapt over his fallen brother. He charged me with wild thrusts of his spear, and since the weapon gave him a better reach than me, I was forced to leap back some more.
"Die, stinking human, die!"
the leader barked. He lunged forward with a strike meant to skewer my liver, but I slapped the strike aside with my sword and stepped into his guard. My axe came down as his other arm came up, and I buried the blade in his thick forearm. I thought that would have been the end of the fight, since I'd pretty much cut off his arm, but he surprised me by switching his grip on the spear to his other hand so he could continue to attack me with his one good arm. I leaned back like a limbo champion and rolled away as he stabbed the air above me. The goblin was already pulling back for another strike, and I twisted out of the way as the spear tip hit the stone where I had just been an instant before. The axe was still buried in the goblin's arm, but he seemed not to notice as he thrust his spearhead toward me. I rolled twice, sprang up with my sword in hand, twisted my body away from a thrust he aimed at my stomach, and then chopped the spear in half with my short sword.
"Tell your gods that it was Fezzi Durk who sent you to hell."
The goblin roared as he tossed aside the useless weapon and pulled my axe out of his arm. I slapped aside the axe and tried to stab him with my sword. He spun out of the way and then swept the axe up high to take off my head. I ducked beneath the blow, danced to the right, and chopped off his hand at the wrist when he moved to swing again. This time he felt it. Blood spurted from the wound and painted the floor dark red as he screamed. Then I slapped the axe out of his remaining hand and slammed the pommel of my sword into his face. His nose cracked as he fell, and a heartbeat later I stood over him with the tip of my sword at his throat. "You lose, Fez," I said.
"It's Fezzy Durg, you human filth."
"Sorry, Fuzzy Turd. Listen, I need to know what else that kobold told you about the princess."
"Go mate with a bugbear,"
he screamed. I kicked him in the side of the head. "I'm going to get the information out of you one way or another, Fez, so you might as well start singing now."
"Eat Minotaur shit."
I dragged him to his feet, headbutted him, and then slammed him against the stone wall. "What else did the kobold tell you?"
"He told me..."
The goblin began. "What? What did he say about the princess?"
"He told me that you fornicate with your mother."
Fezzy Durg screamed. I punched him in the face about a half a dozen times and let him drop to the floor. Then I took my rope out of my pack and tied it to a jutting stone. I tied the other end to Fezzy Durg's feet and dragged him toward the ledge.
"Where are you taking me?"
he asked groggily. "I'm going to throw you off this ledge."
"Okay, I'll talk,"
he screamed.
"The dirty kobold said that he chased an ugly goblin into these caves. He said they had her cornered, but then a human showed up and slaughtered most of them."
"What else did he say?"
"Nothing, I swear."
"You're lying, spit it out," I urged.
He said that later he went back with others and chased the princess and the man out of a cave and into the daylight.
Prickles crept up my spine. "What happened to the princess after that?" I asked.
"He said that she didn't burn. Somehow she didn't burn,"
Fezzy Durg said. "Have you told anyone else about this? Did anyone else hear the kobold's confession?"
"No, it was only me there, and I didn't tell no one. I didn't believe him. Monsters can't go out into the sunlight."
"Hmm," I said as I continued to haul him toward the edge.
"You going to let me go now, human scum?"
Fezzy Durg asked, and his voice was lined with fear. "Nope," I said as I cut the rope around his ankles. Then I tossed him over the side of the cliff. He screamed something unintelligible as he fell, and then I heard another splat when his body hit the ground. I found his severed hand and tossed it over the edge along with his broken spear. Then I did the same with Urgog's body before I picked up my axe and hightailed it out of there. It had been a really successful exploration, but now I needed to get back to Nika and tell her what I had learned. I also needed to ask if her father really was the king, and if he was going to send his army after her. Chapter 10. I emerged from the Underdark with my loot and carried it to the house. The first sun had already set, and the second was a few hours away. A half hour later, I reached the homestead, but I didn't find Nika there. My stomach dropped as I glanced around for her, but then I heard a distant humming noise, and I saw her down by the river as she chilled naked in the hammock. "Honey, I'm home," I called in a sing-song voice as I headed down the hill with my loot.
"I'm over here," she sang back.
When I reached the hammock, I saw Nika munching on fish and beaming at me. Her belly was huge, and if she was a human woman, I would have guessed that she was a few weeks away from giving birth.
"Come," she said as she rubbed her belly. "Your son is kicking. Come and feel it. He's so strong."
"Damn, this is crazy," I whispered as I walked over and knelt beside the hammock. Nika guided my hand to her bulbous green belly, and I waited with mounting anticipation. Nothing happened, and she repositioned my hand.
"He was kicking a moment ago," she said.
"Let me listen," I told her as I took her belly in my hands like a globe and pressed my ear to it. The baby kicked me in the ear with the strength of an adult flicking a finger, and I let out a curse as I stumbled back.
Nika laughed, and I soon joined her.
You're right about the baby being strong, I said as I rubbed my ear.
Look what I made,
she said happily as she pointed at the bridge. I put down my loot and walked over to the footbridge. Nika had crafted a net out of vines and moored it to both sides of the shore. There were at least 20 fat trout swimming against the net, and I felt my chest swell with pride.
That's really clever, Nika. We're going to be up to our ears in fish, but I have a feeling that once I come back from town, you aren't going to want any fish for a while.
Huh, are you crazy?
She asked. She scrunched up her face when she said it, and I had to laugh.
Not half as crazy as you're going to be when I introduce you to beef, I told her.
Beef, she said. What's that?
It's from a cow, I said. They're big horned animals. Well, the bulls are anyway.
Oh, she said. They sound like minotaurs. I once ate minotaur, and if a cow is half as tasty as that was, I'll be the happiest goblin queen in the entire Underdark.
Oh, they're tasty, all right. With the loot I got this time around, I think I can definitely buy a couple cows, maybe even a herd.
I emptied the contents of my molly pack on the ground, and Nika's eyes widened as she struggled to maneuver herself out of the hammock with her big green belly.
Kenjul,
she said in a hushed tone after I helped her sit up.
You are amazing. And you got basilisk meat? Oh, yay!
Yup, and lizard brains, tadpoles, lichen, mushroom caps, 4 basilisk teeth, axes, coins, jewelry. It was a hell of a trip.
Kenjul, you are the best provider a goblin woman could ever want.
Nika turned and hugged me fiercely.
Or a goblin princess, I said, arching my eyebrow.
Hmm?
She raised an eyebrow.
You didn't tell me you were the daughter of one of the tribe leaders, I clarified.
Oh,
she said as she smiled and nodded.
Yes, my dada is the goblin king of our tribe. How did you find out?
I ran into 3 goblins who were hunting for you. The leader had caught one of the kobolds that we fought with when we first met, and the kobold told him all about us. The little shit also told the goblin that you had escaped through a cave and out into the sun.
Fuck,
she said, having picked up the word from me some time back.
Fuck is right. I took care of them, but I don't know if they told anyone else, like your father.
Nika, why didn't you tell me that you were a princess?
She shrugged her shoulders.
You never asked, and it didn't really matter.
Ha, I said, try again. Why didn't you want me to know?
I was ashamed, she sighed. My father is a mean, fat, lazy, bad pillow.
What? A bad pillow? I asked.
Yes, it is a saying. You know, he is too soft.
I chuckled at that. All right, so what's that mean? He's not a strict enough king?
Not at all, Nika confirmed. He has let the kobolds overrun our halls, and he has done nothing to stop the dwarves from taking back their territory. I think that soon my uncle will seize power. It is for the best, really.
Does your father love you? I asked. Was he good to you?
I have 27 sisters, so it is hard for him to give us all attention. He doesn't even know half our names. He always knew mine, though. Everyone knew the name of the ugliest princess in the clan.
Stop with that. I lifted her chin. You're beautiful and you know it, Nika. You're my shining emerald princess.
Oh, Kenjul, she said teary-eyed. Then you're not mad at me?
Nah, I said. How can I be mad at you? But if you have any other little secrets like that one, now would be a good time to just get it all out in the open.
Nope, she said as she shook her head. No more secrets.
Great, I said as I smiled at her. So why is he still looking for you? From what you say, they all thought you were ugly.
They also know I'm clever, Nika said with a shrug. Goblins are kinda stupid. I had to teach the whole clan not to eat where you poop, and not to drink water that was old. They also never left traps to catch anything, and just formed hunting parties. I also got them to start growing mushrooms and moss instead of just gathering it. Oh, and I made the best-looking clothes.
So your father wants you back to help run the tribe? I asked.
He always said mean things to me, she sighed. They all did, but maybe now that I am gone, they realize I was smart. I don't know, Kenjul. All I know is that I'm so happy to be your wife, and